Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, February 14th, 2021. And today, we're going to talk about more eyeballs. The eyeballs are shifting. They're shifting from one platform to another platform, from linear to digital. And we will try to make sense of all of these numbers that no one can make sense of. And we will just obfuscate them and then make the problem go away. But anyway, we will talk about an interview that Nick Khan had with Forbes. New Japan made a deal to put its content in the US, UK, and Canada with Roku. We haven't talked about that yet. WWE employees have had their raises and promotions frozen in time. And does the fact that WWE is a publicly traded company that has a lot of guaranteed revenue, does that affect WWE's creative output? And if we have time, I will talk about the outlook of the independent wrestling world. But first, all right. So I've been driven nuts again by the analysis of the viewership data. Frequent listeners of this program may know that I often start out this section of the program by talking about wrestling viewership, the latest numbers in viewership data that we've learned in the week that just passed. And I'm wondering if, again, the micro-analysis that others and even I do on a week-to-week basis is really helpful and insightful, or if it's more misleading than helpful and insightful. And maybe a solution to that is to just talk about monthly averages more, maybe something like that, and to focus more on, yes, the ranking of the program on its given night, which Showbiz Daily makes very clear in its daily posted rankings, but also talk about the comparison that we can make of the trends of the five programs that we have data about, comparing those trends to the trends of cable overall, in particular, non-news cable, because that is a more stable and normal metric to look at. So here's an attempt at that. First, to just talk about things in a qualitative way. What is the state of SmackDown, Raw, Dynamite, NXT, and Impact right now? What are the state of those programs? What are the state of those trends? To understand that, I have lined up the viewership of those four programs, monthly averages, put all that data into monthly averages for each program, and comparing the given month to the year to the same month of the year prior. So looking at February of this year to February of last year, January of this year to January of last year, and so on. Naturally, a lot of those numbers are going to be negative comparisons by percent. That's what we expect. But what I want to measure that year-over-year change against is the year-over-year change of non-news cable. So in February, we're in the middle of the month of February, so we've got probably 2 out of 4 data points for the given programs. Nonetheless, in February so far, with the data that we have, non-news cable is down 25% in total audience. We'll talk about the, I know the key demo is the only thing that matters, but we'll talk about the key demo in a moment. But in total audience, non-news cable, by my measurement, by the data that is available through our friends at showbuzzdaily.com, non-news cable is down 25%. I'm going to say that again because that's important to remember, and to talk about WrestleNomics in audio can be weird sometimes. Non-news cable is down 25% in February from the February of last year, at this moment anyway. So I think that negative 25% is a good benchmark. If you're doing worse than that, well, maybe your program isn't doing well. If you're doing better than that, well, maybe your program is doing well. So how do the five programs compare to that negative 25% year-over-year change? Well, they're all doing at least a little bit better than that. NXT comes the closest at a negative 23%. Raw comes the next closest at a negative 21%. I'm reticent to talk about the numbers and just start listing off. Yes, Dynamite is negative 10%. SmackDown, negative 19%. Impact doing the best at negative 11%. I would categorize this qualitatively, which is probably the best way to talk about it in audio, in that Impact seems to be trending the best. No, that's not true. Impact and AEW are doing about the same, trending pretty well relative to the year prior. But everybody's doing better than non-news cable overall. But what about the key demo? In the key demo for non-news cable is down 29%, and NXT is doing well below that, negative 43%. So NXT appears to be suffering quite a bit in the key demo of 18 to 49, but everybody else is doing at least the same or better. In fact, Impact is in a positive comparison, up 15% from the prior year. Granted, I'm making that calculation based on the demo rating number that we get, which when we're talking about in the range between 100,000 and 200,000 viewers, that's a very small range to be looking at and converting a 100th decimal. See, this is ridiculous to talk in audio, but trust me that Impact seems to be doing well in terms of trending. Dynamite doing pretty well as well. SmackDown doing okay. Raw barely doing okay, and NXT not doing that well. Of course, when we're talking about absolute viewers, SmackDown and Raw are in their own stratosphere, doing nearly 2 million viewers every week. In fact, SmackDown was down substantially this past Friday. I don't know why. And then Dynamite and NXT are in a stratosphere below that, where Dynamite leads NXT every week since late October, and leads in the key demo every week for more than a year running. And then in a stratosphere very close to the earth is Impact Wrestling. And oh my God, there's been news viewership. Yes, news viewership has had an effect on pro wrestling viewership, especially on Wednesdays, on days such as the day after the presidential election in November, on days such as January 6th, on the day that the Capitol was attacked, when there was a lot of news viewership. It's not altogether clear to me that news viewership has been as affecting of pro wrestling viewership in at least this week, as some have said. So I think there's that point to consider. So when you look at TV overall, and I think that is the way to look at this, is to take a metric like the one I found here for, let's take all the non-news cable, let's take the five, what I've actually done is take the top 50 programs that are not on CNN, Fox News, or MSNBC, the top 50 programs for every single day, and measure the trends of that group of data, that group of programs, against wrestling viewership. And the gift, though, of having all these wrestling programs now, rather than just Raw and SmackDown, or an Impact that's doing well below it, the gift of having NXT and Dynamite in the conversation is that you can compare the trends of these programs to one another. And if you can do that over a large space of time, the point that people like to raise that but all TV is down. Well, you can compare the trends of these programs to one another. And because you can compare them relatively, you can get an idea of what the trend and what the trajectory and the momentum or lack thereof is of any of these programs. So anyway, we will revisit those points probably in the moments to come here when we talk about how Nick Khan, following the earnings call on Thursday, February 4th, this past week that just passed, had an interview with Forbes, with Alfred Kanawha of Forbes, where he talked about viewership. And I understand this interview was scheduled before the Thursday earnings call, but he seems to be addressing the eyeballs comments that he made on the earnings call. So we will go through some of the quotes that he gives to Alfred Kanawha of Forbes here, where he talks about viewership, where Nick Khan, who, by the way, is the WWE president and chief revenue officer, known for making favorable media rights deals for WWE in the past. He says to Forbes, quote, "In all my time in LA, since SmackDown started in October 2019, through when I moved to Connecticut," he recently moved from LA to Connecticut to become the chief revenue officer and president for WWE. But anyway, he says, "I watched every episode of SmackDown live on the app. So my viewership, your viewership, are not counted in the ratings. It's not simply, hey, there is a departure, people are watching on YouTube, Facebook, etc. People are watching the direct-to-consumer product," he's talking about the app, "which only Fox knows how many folks are watching that. Fox seems quite pleased to us with overall viewership, and that's the nuance in what I was attempting to say during the earnings call." So Nick Khan makes that point, but I would still point out that you can compare the trends of Raw to the trends of Dynamite, even of SmackDown, which SmackDown has been doing better than Raw in my reading of the data. You can compare at least the ratings of Raw and the trends of Raw over the last, let's say, 12 months, and see how the viewership of Raw in particular, you could even argue NXT has suffered in this way as well. From the pandemic, from the middle of March, Raw ratings declined quite a bit, and they continued to decline until the summer, until the Thunderdome happened, until Roman Reigns came back. That really helped out SmackDown. And you can see that AEW Dynamite did not suffer in the same way. In addition to that, if we're talking about popularity, and if we're talking about to what extent does viewership tell us something about the popularity of the brand, we can look at the viewership of Raw compared to the viewership of non-news cable overall and see how in 2019 and 2020, Raw declined worse than non-news cable in 2019 and in 2020. But if we're talking about other ways to read the popularity trends of the WWE brand, we can look at trends. It's hard because now we've lived through this year of 2020 where a lot of the economic habits of consumers was greatly interrupted. But even if we look before 2020, we know that paid attendance, both average and total, both North American and international, had been in multi-year declines since 2017. We could look at merchandise sales and see that those were in decline since about 2017. We can look at product licensing revenues and see that that was in decline since about 2017. We can look at streaming subscriptions for the WWE Network and see that that was on the decline throughout 2019. They did climb back up in 2020, I would note, in a year where streaming was embraced on a wider level by consumers generally. Streaming subscriptions for the WWE Network increased from the year prior, but still have not reached or exceeded the level of 2018. And we see that Google web search for WWE has been on the decline since 2016. Meanwhile, Google web search for other sports leagues has not suffered similarly. That's both US-based Google web searches and worldwide-based Google web searches. And in particular, if we talk about wrestling viewership again, the viewership of Raw and SmackDown again, we see that people of the age of 18 to 34 especially seem to have tuned out of W programs. The key demo, for example, 18 to 49, makes up about half, or maybe a little bit more than half. Let's check the PDF before I say something too certainly here. And by the PDF, I mean the WrestleNomics Pro Wrestling Industry Report for the year of 2020, which you can get on PayHip for just $6, a 63-page document. I did not plan this plug, but here it is. A 63-page document telling you nearly everything you would want to know about the professional wrestling industry, the key metrics, and things of that nature. You can get that on PayHip for $6 or become a patron at patreon.com/WrestleNomics for just $5 a month, and you will get that report as part of your monthly support. In addition to the notes that I often make as a result of doing this podcast, in addition to access to the Wrestling Viewership Spreadsheet 2.0 with tens of thousands of data points and tabs upon tabs of analysis, the spreadsheet that I use to keep track of wrestling viewership. Again, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, that's $5 a month. You get all that and the 2020 report. Anyway, the point that I'm building to is that WWE appears to have a young viewer problem that is not as much of a problem for AEW. Why do I think that? Because about 50%, just about 50% exactly, of the AEW linear, not digital, not Facebook, not YouTube, not social, not internet, not online, the linear audience for AEW Dynamite, 50% of it is in the key demo of 18 to 49. 50% of it is outside of it, right? For Raw, 39% is in that key demo. For SmackDown, 36% of it is in the key demo. For NXT, 35% of it is in the key demo. In fact, for Impact, it's even lower. 27%. Only 27% is in the key demo. And again, for Dynamite, it's 50%. Granted, Dynamite is, let's not forget, Dynamite is doing about, what, less than half of the total audience of Raw or SmackDown. Just to make sure things are still in perspective. But anyway, the point is, WWE seems to have a young viewer problem that is not as pronounced, at least in the case of AEW. So Nikon goes on in this Forbes interview with Alfred Kanawa, where he says, quote, no matter when people start watching, they're always going to obviously get older. So you always have to figure out a way to get young people in. So what we're in the middle of, the Bad Bunny thing, that's obviously tailored toward a young audience. We're in the process now of developing a number of different animated properties, some with the desired demographic of 2 to 6 years old. So the thought is to get kids young. We're also reevaluating our entire gaming strategy. So that's interesting. And he's talking about the animated series here with 2 to 6. That's a really young demographic. It's probably the age that I was when I first started to engage with World Wrestling Federation products, whether that was action figures or video games. And Bad Bunny is did very well for them with the e-commerce stuff that they put out related to that. So, but has that resulted in a sudden increase in 18 to 34 viewers, for example? Apparently not, but maybe those eyeballs have increased on digital, but who knows? In other comments in this interview with Nick Khan, he also says, quote, so I'm not convinced that there are a group of 15-year-olds watching linear television who just don't happen to be watching us. They're finding our content elsewhere, and we have to get to them before they're even 15 to make sure we have a chance to win over new fans, so when the other fans start to phase out and get older, we always have a new population coming in, end quote. Yeah, so I think all this makes sense in a vacuum. In the particular real life situation of WWE, though, this is a problem with the creative and a problem with I think the over reliance to act on the temptation that is presented by bringing back older talent and probably a lack of belief within Vince McMahon in many younger talents, with many exceptions, right? We'll talk about Drew McIntyre in a moment. But I think there's a lack of willingness to accept and a lack of understanding of how to present and how to market and how to develop younger talent once they get to the main roster, which is largely, if not completely, the responsibility and a result of the influence of the CEO, chairman of the board, Class B shareholder, controlling Class B shareholder, Vince McMahon. Nonetheless, executive vice president of WWE, Paul Levesque, he was asked about the ratings and how he defines success for NXT, and he echoed many of the comments that Nick Khan has made. So here's Paul Levesque from the media conference call earlier this week.
I wanted to ask you about ratings and the way you kind of qualify success at this point, because Nick Khan in the recent earnings call talked about how his vision is that there's still eyeballs in the company, but the eyeballs have shifted to different platforms. And we're in the middle of a lot of shifts that will affect NXT in the next couple of months, in the next year. Peacock, obviously, and the NBC Sports Network shutting down, and hockey possibly going to Wednesday nights on the USA Network. When you look at the overnights versus the plus threes, the plus sevens, you know, what do you quantify as rating success at this point, especially when you see drops at certain points from week to week? NXT's been on the USA Network for about a year and a half now. Like, how do you look at it and how do you measure the success of the ratings, especially now as things have kind of changed and we're at the precipice of more changes for the company in terms of its relationship with NBCU?
Yeah, look, I think Nick said it best, in that you're talking about eyeballs and consumption. So in any of our brands, Raw, SmackDown, you know, NXT is no different. You're looking about how are people consuming the product. The world is changing. In some way you would say to yourself, well, and again, not talking about our industry at all, but you say, well, television consumption is down across the board. Are people just watching less content? No, they're watching more content. People are on their phones 24/7. People are watching content on so many different platforms and streaming devices and apps and everything in between, that to not consider those as platforms that are taking your eyeballs. I think Nick said it in a clarification the other day in an interview that he did, of like, even for him, watching SmackDown, he watched it on an app for quite a few months. You know, those don't count in television ratings. They count clearly. That's a fan watching the show, if you want to look at it in that manner, but it doesn't count as a television rating. You have to look at them across the board. To just say that in today's world, all that matters is one of those platforms, any given one, is like just naive to all the other platforms. It really is. You have to take into consideration everything. You have to take into consideration where people are, when they're watching it, how they're watching it. People want to watch on their times. Appointment television is not the same conversation it was 15 years ago. So we take that into consideration just like everything else. I'm very happy with where we are, but always looking for it to be a lot better. It's that you're never content, never, you know, happy with where it is. You want it to grow. You want it to be more. You want to get more eyeballs. The Peacock thing is another example of that. The opportunity for us to have more eyeballs across the board from so many people in so many different ways is incredible, and that's all part of this engagement and driving people to watch the product when they want to, not when and where and when you want them to.
So again, there's Triple H, Paul Levesque, taking a question from Mike Johnson of PW Insider about ratings. I don't think anything he says there explains away the trends that we're seeing. Let's just talk about NXT. Again, down 43% year over year so far in February. And I'm looking at, again, these monthly year over year comparisons, because now we're getting to the point where NXT and AEW have been around for more than a year, and we're getting away from those months where maybe they did exceptionally high viewership out of curiosity and, you know, in the hype of the debuts. Similar for SmackDown, where over a year now into their run, into SmackDown's run on Fox, and leveling away from the big months of, say, October 2020 or October 2019 to do that comparison with. So another thing that I would look at to measure success for NXT or any of these other programs is the rank of the program on its night. NXT in Q4, its median rank was 51. And that's been, it's been slipping down lower in its median rank for each quarter. So let's talk about Q1 2020, 35, a median rank of 35. Q2 it falls, median rank of 46. Q3 it goes up to a median rank of 28. Q4 back down to its lowest median rank for a quarter up to that point at 51. Right now it's a median rank in Q1 is 65. So I don't know. If I'm NXT, I'm probably not happy with, for one thing, I'm not beating AEW. That seems to be getting more decisively out of reach. And I'm not sure. I don't know enough to know how that's going to affect NXT's media rights value going forward, mainly because I just don't know what the media rights value right now of NXT is. NXT's deal appears to be up in the fall. So that deal probably being renegotiated right now, and I would expect NXT to stay where it is, but does it get a raise? Does it get a big increase? One of the reasons why it was justified publicly, why NXT was moved off to the WWE Network and onto linear television, the USA Network, was because WWE said it wanted to not compete with AEW. No, it didn't say that, but it wanted to grow the brand value and the media rights value of NXT. Is that happening 2 years into this? I don't know, and I don't know if we'll get an answer, but we'll see. But there's a three-way tension whenever we're talking about viewership here, which makes things difficult to understand, terrible to try to discuss on Twitter. And there's three things. There's, what are we trying to understand when we look at viewership? I think that in part, we are trying to understand the popularity of the program or of the brand. We are trying to understand the relation of the popularity to the creative output, or is such and such star getting over and contributing to upward or downward trends in that popularity? And separate from that, quite separate from that, counterintuitively, what does the viewership that we're looking at mean for the media rights value of the program? And I think the popularity is going down. I think the creative output is bad. And I think the media rights value is going up. I don't know if that's the case in NXT, but that's the case for Raw and SmackDown. Raw is ranking quite highly now that it's not opposed by the NFL with Monday Night Football. Even when it was opposed by the NFL with Monday Night Football, it was still finishing in the top five just about every week. So I do buy the argument. I do buy the PR statement from WWE that Fox is happy with SmackDown. I do buy the notion that USA Network is pretty happy with Raw. I don't know if USA Network is that happy with NXT, but it's still giving them 52 weeks a year of 2 hours of live content that's more DVR proof, that finishes relatively highly, doesn't always make the top 50, but it's doing all right. It's not beating TNT on the same night, but it's doing all right. It's doing better than something else would probably in that slot, and it's doing it at a relatively low cost. And I think Raw and SmackDown continue, even as much as they cost USA Network and Fox to run them, you know, $265 million a year for Raw on average over the five-year deal, $205 million over the five-year deal on average for SmackDown. Still, those programs are providing 2 hours or 3 hours of weekly first-run live content the whole year round for a relatively inexpensive cost. And not only are they doing that, but their viewership is highly viewed, despite that viewership often declining worse than television viewership ratings and television viewership trends overall. So yes, your brand in this world of professional wrestling, in this world of media, can decline in popularity because of the bad creative, while still growing in value. Because you still have enough of an audience. I think WWE has damaged its brand with consumers while enhancing its brand with business partners. But you can damage your brand with consumers to an extent, to the extent that WWE has, and still remain popular enough that you happen to have this content, which is live sports-like content, that is multiplying in value over time. And you are maintaining enough of an audience. It may be the more non-discerning portion of the audience, but you're maintaining enough of an audience to maintain enormous media rights values that will carry you well on into the future, despite the fact that you have a CEO and head of creative who's increasingly out of touch and increasingly putting out more bad content than good. And the reason why this discussion is so hard to have on low information, high outrage platforms like Twitter is that it may appear that you're defending the bad content or letting WWE off the hook for producing more bad content than good. It's easy for WWE executives and anybody who's defending WWE to obfuscate the data and obfuscate the trends of what's happening. It's pretty soon you start talking about linear and digital eyeballs and the viewership and the behavior shifting over from this platform to that platform. You can't just talk about one thing, you've got to talk about the other thing, and this is happening across the board, and we all have personal experiences that may tell us that this makes sense. This is intuitive, that yes, people are you know, your kids are never going to watch linear TV. Your kids never watch linear TV now, and everybody's, you know, watching Netflix and looking at their phones 24/7, and everyone has some personal experience with that. And before you know it, you've been distracted by what's really happening, which is, again, Raw has diminished in viewership worse than cable overall has in 2019 and 2020. And there's other evidence that supports the notion that WWE has declined in popularity over time in the last 3 to 4 years. And you can find that by looking at paid attendance, merchandise sales, licensing revenues, streaming subscriptions, and Google web search. But it takes a hell of a lot of time and research and work to unpack that. And before you know it, the water is too muddy to make any sense of this anyway. But not for you. You listen to WrestleNomics and you get it. And you understand.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
But anyway, New Japan Pro Wrestling is on Roku. Right now, it is on Roku. 2 weeks ago, this was news that came out the same week as the WWE earnings call. So we have not talked about it yet. But New Japan is on the Roku channel. the press release makes it clear that New Japan content will be available on the Roku channel in the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Canada. New Japan will have a one-hour weekly series that premiered on February 11th, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. Is that Eastern time? Is that Pacific time? I don't know. The press release didn't say. But there will be the first 10 episodes are going to cover Wrestle Kingdom 14, which is from the year of 2020. So not this year's Wrestle Kingdom, but 2020's Wrestle Kingdom. And I have looked at the Roku channel, and they're all there to watch. There's a number, I guess 10 of them, 48 or so minute episodes that are, showing matches from Wrestle Kingdom 14. They're available right now. The Roku channel will host a block of library content from 2020 with potential for introduction of more historical content in the future. According to the press release, Roku channel reached 62 million people in the U.S. in Q4 2020. What does reached mean? I couldn't tell you. The Observer, the Wrestling Observer newsletter, also had some details in addition to what the press release said. Access did not subscribe to Nielsen until just after New Japan was off the network. So there was no Nielsen data that could be used to sell a deal for New Japan. So you couldn't take the credible Nielsen data and show it to various media partners and say, here, this is what we can deliver. I think there was some other research and data service that Axis might have been using before the Anthem acquisition, but the industry does not trust information that's not from Nielsen as much as it trusts information that is from Nielsen. So that was a problem in the way of making a really great deal. According to the Observer, there had been talks with ESPN and Vice, among others, but the lack of viewership numbers from Nielsen for the show on Access didn't lead to a deal there. There was interest, according to the Observer, from the CBS Sports Network, but only an ad revenue split was offered. That seems to imply, the Observer seems to imply then, that this Roku deal involves guaranteed rights fees. No word, though, on the value. I would expect it to be, not that much money for New Japan. But anyway, we'll get into it in a moment. But anyway, the New Japan deal with Roku, according to the Observer, is not exclusive. So if the show is a success and Roku does provide access to viewership data, the data can be used then to get a second deal with different content. Which is confusing to me because I don't know that, Roku is obviously not a linear channel, so it's not as if Roku is going to provide Nielsen data the way that a television network would. So what do I think of New Japan getting a deal with Roku? I think it's better than not having one. It's better than not having really any media distribution in the US, UK, and Canada, which is what it had previously and throughout 2020, since it lost its deal with Access. Now, Access is a television network, obviously currently airing Impact Wrestling. It's in about half of the cable homes, so that means it's probably in about a third of the U.S. homes. So Access wasn't this great television network, but at least it was in a substantial number of U.S. homes. I think this is not nearly as good as being on Access, because it doesn't allow people to easily discover it. I'm not going to be looking through my, I don't do this, but people do this. They look through the channel guide on their TV, and you can, sort of page through it and scroll through it. And then you see wrestling. What's this? New Japan Pro Wrestling? And I think people discovered New Japan on Access that way. That's not going to happen on Roku. I think this is still a situation. I know there's a linear stream of this program on Thursdays, but I highly doubt this is going to lead to significant discovery of New Japan. Again, this is better than not having it, though. I think New Japan understands that there's revenue opportunities in selling media rights in the U.S. and other Western markets. I think they don't understand how to make it happen. And I think New Japan doesn't understand the difference between U.S. and Japanese media strategies, and that there are cultural differences in how revenue is generated in the U.S. versus Japan, and also that there's a difference in the relationships that have to be developed with broadcasters. And I think New Japan is unwilling to spend money on, say, a U.S. talent agency like Creative Artist Agency or Activist Artist Management. These are the two agencies that helped WWE and AEW, respectively, complete their lucrative media rights deals. I think New Japan is totally unwilling to spend the required amount of money that it would take to make a better deal happen. I understand New Japan hired a Japanese ad agency to explore deals in the U.S. market, and the only offer that they came up with was a deal with Twitch. I think New Japan continues to believe that a live event business is viable in the U.S. in the way that it is in Japan, where, you know, New Japan Pro Wrestling, among these the three top global companies, New Japan Pro Wrestling is the only one that is still primarily a live event business, whereas WWE and AEW are overwhelmingly becoming media businesses. New Japan still makes the majority of its revenue from ticket sales and other event revenues. I think New Japan thinks that they can do a number of shows or develop a bigger live event business in the United States, and I think they are overestimating the ticket demand that they're going to be able to capture. They'll still be able to do big shows, maybe, on an annual basis or a quarterly basis in certain geographies after COVID, and they'll still be able to draw in traveling fans. I think selling out Madison Square Garden is still possible, but doing these smaller scale shows, perhaps with only the New Japan Strong crew and a sprinkling of Japanese mainstays, is not going to draw more than a few hundred people. So this is what New Japan has for now. They have Roku, and I don't see things getting a lot better in the foreseeable future, if ever, in terms of New Japan getting a strong media distribution deal in the U.S. And it's also complicated by the fact that, you know, you're in Japan, and they do have English commentary now, and after the pandemic, you know, they'll be able to get Kevin Kelly and people over there to do live commentary more often. But there's still the time difference is a problem in terms of getting the live value out of it, right? In the East Coast, when New Japan has its events, it's the crack of dawn, 4 a.m., 2 a.m., something like that. So that diminishes the opportunity to do a live broadcast that generates a lot of live viewership. So there's that complication. But what comes first is that I think New Japan is not prepared to invest the money that would be needed to find a really great deal that could help grow its popularity in the U.S. and globally, and is particularly in English-speaking markets. So, you know, New Japan has a great product. It's got it's the one company in recent years in pro wrestling that has grown its popularity substantially, I think largely through delivering a great product. Yet it doesn't have a strong media strategy, which is sort of the opposite problem that I think WWE has. In other news, WWE employees had their raises and promotions frozen. This was originally reported by PW Insider. This news comes on Wednesday. At least some employees were told of the decision on Wednesday. I understand people, this is the corporate side. This is not related to wrestlers or talent, presumably, who are under specific contracts. But I think employees are very unhappy, especially the people who have been working on the road and had to work through a number of COVID outbreaks. Many are disappointed to learn that during the busiest time of the year, the Rumble to WrestleMania season, after having to pick up additional work during furloughs where other employees were sent home and furloughed, the employees who remained behind picked up the work of those absent and furloughed employees, and now they've learned that they are not getting the raises or promotions that maybe they were expecting. And employees are still unclear on whether there will be cuts related to the Peacock deal, where Obviously, Peacock, as we talked about before, is acquiring the rights to WWE Network content in the U.S. Is that going to mean that there's going to be employee position cuts because certain work is being absorbed by Peacock? That is unclear, and employees still don't know. WWE, by the way, still as profitable as ever. Net income for 2020 was a new record for annual net income adjusted for inflation throughout the history of the company. But what could be motivating this? I have no idea. I guess just that WWE probably, you know, in Q4, it was clear that expenses were higher than many analysts, including myself, expected. The Thunderdome is quite expensive. Profitability in Q4, while Q4 was profitable, and again, 2020 overall was the most profitable year ever. Q4's profitability came in lower than expected. The stock price fell substantially as a result. Not a huge catastrophic fall, but the stock price has been ticking down and had some bad days following the report. Currently, as of Friday, trading at $46, which is down quite a bit from the news of the Peacock deal, where the stock was up at $10 from where it is now, up to as much as $57. So there was this big peak, this big bubble, just following the Peacock deal announcement. And the stock has gone right back down to where it was before the Peacock deal. So anyway, I think, you know, Q4 was disappointing in terms of profitability. WWE has given guidance for 2021. The profitability for 2021 is in a range that is right in between where profitability was and was reported for 2020. So basically, WWE is projecting that it's going to have a 2021 that is just as, no more, but no less profitable than 2020, which is not what I would have expected, and I think that's not what most analysts would have expected. Given the escalating nature of media rights fees, you would think that would lead to greater profitability over time. But the Thunderdome is quite expensive, and WWE is going to be paying for the Thunderdome on a recurring basis for the foreseeable future until events can go back on tour. So it looks like maybe WWE is looking to cut some costs, in this case, in the form of freezing raises and promotions during its most profitable years ever. So it just looks like a case of putting shareholders' interests before employees' interests. And who's the largest shareholder in WWE? Vince owns 1/3 of all WWE shares. But to be fair, it's not like he's going to sell anytime soon. Although he does have a complicated deal with Morgan Stanley that I don't totally understand. And maybe raising the stock price would benefit that agreement that he's made to sell his shares over time to some of his shares, a portion of his shares over time to Morgan Stanley. Vince, by the way, before anybody freaks out, is the controlling shareholder because he has Class B shares, which give him 10 times the voting power of any common shareholder. So he maintains about 80% of the voting power. By the way, I wanted to touch on some other things that Nikhan said in the interview with Forbes, just briefly. He says, quote, "I think the Drew McIntyre thing is working as a potential next breakthrough star," Khan says. "Certainly he has the look, he has the dedication, and he has the right attitude, and I think he's being put onto the right platform." Just interesting to note, I just want to note that it's apparent that Nick Khan is watching the current programming, which I never could confidently say when listening to George Berrios or Michelle Wilson, for that matter. Not that we heard a lot from Michelle Wilson as much as we did Berrios, but it is I don't know how much it matters, but it's notable. And one other thing from the Forbes interview: is NBC Universal interested in acquiring WWE? It makes increasing sense to me that NBC Universal would acquire WWE, or maybe that acquisition would be on the table in 2022, 2023, when they start to renegotiate the current deal for Raw. You've bought the rights to the network content. You own the rights to the Raw content. Why not just own the entire company outright? on that question, Nick Khan says, quote, "We haven't discussed it once at all. By the way, we're thrilled with being on network TV at Fox. I think I sort of pushed on the emphasis during the earnings call on broadcast television and how important it is. So we love that. We love what we're doing with NBC. But no, there has been no dialogue internally or externally on anything like that." So I know that that's within the realm of the answer that you would expect to a question like that. I believe that's probably the case, that there's been no discussion about it. That doesn't mean it won't be discussed in the future. In other thought, there's an interesting discussion that I listened to this week between Todd Martin and Wade Keller of the PW Torch on The Fix this week, which is, I think, a really intelligent discussion every week of wrestling and the creative output and the business. There's the question of how do factors like guaranteed media revenue and WWE's publicly traded stock, how do those factors, these corporate factors, if you will, how do they affect WWE's creative output? I think this is something that is in the atmosphere of wrestling fan discussion, that it's a publicly traded company now, and there's this guaranteed revenue now. They don't have to do this, or they're going to do that, or they're not going to take as many risks or chances. Sort of the notion that because WWE is not motivated as much, or is not affected as much in terms of its total revenue makeup, it's not affected as much by consumer purchases, consumer behavior, that WWE may not be as motivated, or I guess Vince in particular, as the head of creative, may not be as motivated to take serious chances, or I think ultimately what we're getting at is doing something that would make the fan in question feel that the product is better. Or is the product being, in a sense, developed for business partners and for investors more so than it is for fans? So let's try to, there's a lot there, right? But let's try to unpack some of that. So occasionally I talk with analysts and investors who cover WWE stock, and some are definitely making an effort to understand the creative. I think some are even watching the product, at least from time to time. And in this discussion with Wade and Todd, they were not affirming this, but investors and stock people are definitely not watching Raw or SmackDown and forming like price target opinions, or forming serious opinions, or having their opinions swayed about the stock value. Wall Street people are mainly looking at SEC filings and listening to executives' comments on the call, looking at other things they say publicly, probably, for example, in that interview with Nick Khan and Forbes. And they're computing all that information and other facts and beliefs that they have about the wider industry that affects WWE, especially the media rights market. And that's how that's the vast majority of how those opinions about the stock and what they believe the price target is, that's the vast majority of what is leading to those decisions. I think NBC Universal and Fox, who are probably WWE's two biggest business partners, NBC Universal and Fox, they probably give WWE feedback on creative things that they see, and WWE might take it or leave it. I've heard the story that NBC Universal was behind the idea of doing the 24/7 title. So I know that there's feedback and there's discussions that TV networks give to wrestling companies, both in the case of WWE and AEW. They certainly have limits, at least Fox does, in terms of vulgarity. When Fox, if I recall right, edited the West Coast feed on the that terrible urine-throwing angle between Sheamus and Jeff Hardy a few months back. But I guess the thing I want to make clear is that investors, analysts, TV executives are unlikely to be fazed by much of any of the creative direction that fans care so deeply about. Fans, as I've talked about before, they want economic justice. They want there to be some sort of consequence or even punishment for what they at times perceive to be the bad product coming from companies, including WWE. It would be nice if investors, analysts, and TV executives tuned in at least occasionally and recognized that Raw and SmackDown are generally not good shows, to some extent. Maybe they do. And then use whatever influence they have to guide Vince and WWE to have a better creative direction that helps maximize popularity and revenues. So it's not just about aesthetic taste, but this is about popularity and revenues, streaming subscriptions, consumption, ticket sales, merchandise sales. But there's little distinction being made on the part of people like that. Again, they're focusing on the wider trends, which is really what affects this company. And to the extent that they are following the creative direction of the product, and I don't know, even if a significant group of people in the media industry and the investment world expressed their lack of satisfaction with the creative product to WWE or to Vince, I highly doubt, even if there was a tactful or effective way to communicate that to Vince, that Vince has the capacity at this point to correct course and make the adjustments and changes. Yeah, it's probably not just adjustments, but vast changes that would need to be made to correct course that would maximize revenues and consumption. So when people use the "it's a publicly traded company now" or something along those lines to justify bad or just status quo creative, I don't think that's a good point. And I do think that, on the other hand, WWE having such a wide margin in terms of brand ID and in terms of revenue above any other wrestling company for such a long time, even as that huge margin begins to be somewhat threatened in recent years by AEW, it does reduce some of the urgency that might have once pushed Vince to make better creative decisions. But the problem probably comes before the root problem, probably comes before any of that. Now, in 2021, I think Vince's creative efficacy is gone. Obviously, WWE still has a sufficient critical mass of viewers, consumers, that sustain the media rights value that they have and sustain it enough that it's probably going to grow in the future. But the notion that it's within Vince McMahon's capacity to improve the creative at this point is ridiculous to me. The last 20 years have been a long demonstration in how Vince has been progressively and today finally utterly unable to deliver a compelling product to anything but the diminished captive fan base, while leaving probably millions of people semi-engaged or entirely checked out. So even if, let's say, AEW was a comparable force in terms of business and or in terms of popularity to WWE, and therefore the urgency with Vince was restored because he felt threatened, I think Vince would still fail to rise to the creative challenge, because at this moment in time, his creative instincts have either dulled or become obsolete and useless. You know, those creative instincts were strong enough in the late 90s to be able to cultivate Steve Austin and The Rock into huge stars that led to enormous financial success and enormous growth in consumer metrics, ticket sales, merchandise sales, television ratings. I don't think at this moment in time, in this culture, that he's capable of doing that, even if pressed with enormous urgency. I think this is one of those things that seems kind of obvious to me or implied in the things that I discuss, but maybe is not as clear. So there's that. And finally, as we come up to the top of the hour, some thoughts about independent wrestling, as I have coming up on 1 year since I've last stepped in a ring, in fact. Coming up on 1 year since the pandemic shut down sporting events throughout the U.S. And thinking about what kind of indie wrestling world is there going to be for fans and myself to come back to whenever things return to normal. As we see a number of independent wrestlers getting signed to WWE or AEW or other companies, I think the indies that we once knew, whatever I mean by that, the indies that we once knew are gone, and they're not coming back anytime soon, if ever. What do I mean by that? The previous identity of the indies, I think, relied on major companies overlooking and underappreciating talent that was on the indies, or just on overlooking and underappreciating talent in general. Major companies have finally recalibrated. In my view, major companies finally more appropriately value talent, value skill, and maybe social media has had something to do with raising the profile of the marketability of wrestlers who gain momentum and gain a following on the indies. But there's clearly been a competition with the rise of not just AEW, but before that with the rise of Ring of Honor, of New Japan, Impact Wrestling signing people as well. There's been an increase in competition in the last few years for talent. The previous identity of the indies relied on the undervaluation of that talent from the people who were in charge of various talent relations departments throughout the wrestling world. Once independent talent shows a certain amount of potential in this environment, they will be signed, or at least they will be given offers to be signed. There will be few, I think, and we're talking about when things are back to normal, there will be few, if any, of these renaissance runs on the indies. I think AJ Styles is maybe somebody like that, who had a remarkable renaissance run on the indies, as well as in other companies we would not consider indies, but there will be few, if any, of those kinds of runs where a given wrestler gets released from a major company and goes on to have this resurgence on the indies. I just don't see those people falling through the cracks to get to the indies for more than a handful of shows. There will be too much demand from other major companies that will keep such a wrestler from having any sustained run on the indies. The threshold of signability, if you will, has been lowered substantially and permanently. Now, a cohort of somewhat older indie wrestlers who continue to travel and can't give up the ghost will persist, but these wrestlers will have certain perceived weaknesses in certain areas, personal conduct, perhaps included, or just their history of things that they've done in the past included, and those things will prohibit them from being picked up by a major company. But there will be still others of considerable talent, a few, who will not be lured by the potential of making money in a major company, who might already have good day jobs that they're content with and that they don't want to leave. And even those wrestlers, depending on how good they are, might ultimately get made an offer that they can't turn down that will take them away from the indies. And I know there are some fans who follow independent wrestling closely who lament the proliferation of the irony and comedy gimmicks that have become more popular in recent years, especially in U.S. independent wrestling. And I think there are a lot of forces that compel that trend to emerge. I think the focus on those kinds of gimmicks instead of meaningful programs and great athletic matches, I think that does limit the super indies economically. But even if super indie promoters decide to implement a different creative strategy that valued the protein of athletic drama over the sugar highs of irony, I'm not sure still that the indie wrestling identity of, let's say, I don't know, 2017 ever comes back in this post-COVID world. In a sense, even, the irony gimmicks that maybe have a lower chance of getting signed, those only that fact would only encourage the justification of the super indies to continue to rely on those kinds of talents, who they have greater reason to believe will continue to be available and who they can continue to put titles on and build programs around. So just the independent wrestling being this scene that on the super indie level, of course, being seen as this scene where a lot of talent is underrated and is underappreciated by the higher tiers of the professional wrestling industry, and they exist down here in this underground environment and produce great stuff. I think that era is over, and I don't see how, in a post-COVID world, it comes back. I don't know if that's good or bad for the industry. It's definitely good for wrestlers economically because there'll be more jobs. There will be more competition for the best talent, at least. I don't know if it's good for everyone creatively in terms of their creative satisfaction, but it's good for wrestlers who want to make wrestling their full-time living. There's a greater opportunity to do that now and in the future than at any time in a long, long time. Is that good for fans who want to follow super indie promotions and see a great product? I don't know. But that's how I see things playing out once people are hopefully vaccinated and things can get back to normal, maybe by late 2021. So that's all I have for this time. Again, you can see the notes to this program. You can see, get access to the Wrestling Viewership Spreadsheet 2.0 with tens of thousands of data points and dozens of tabs with analysis on the pro wrestling industry from 2014 to the present. A living document that is updated regularly. You can get access to that at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can get access to the 63-page PDF, the WrestleNomics Pro Wrestling Industry Report, with pages upon pages of graphs and charts and tables across not just television viewership, but live events, consumer products, Google web search, pay-per-view and streaming for the promotions that applies to. Plus written thoughts, insights, and opinions. You can get that at PayHip. That the PayHip link is linked to the pins to the top of the WrestleNomics Twitter account. Or you can just get access to it along with all the other things that you get access to by becoming a patron at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can read my written work at WrestleNomics.com. An article went up that was very much based on a tirade that I had last week on this program called W's Classic Case of Overbranding. That is in written form at WrestleNomics.com right now. That went up this past week. And you can follow WrestleNomics on Twitter. You can follow me at Brandon Thurston, and I'm Brandon Thurston. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.